This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Customers of a landmark downtown Bloomington grocery are much different than they were in the 1970s.
A lot more people want to know exactly the city or town their food comes from. They want to know what those animals were fed. Really getting into details about their food.
The Common Ground celebrates its 40th anniversary. Plus, as the holiday weekend approaches, we take a look at the state of labor. And a kind of reverse ATM has come to Bloomington Normal. You feed it money, and what do you get? That and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The McLean County Democrats are making another run at a Republican incumbent, this time State Representative Keith Sommer. The Morton Republican hasn't had a Democratic challenger in a decade. Jill Blair from Bloomington wants to change that. She's running as a Democrat for Sommer's 88th House District seat. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke to Blair before her formal campaign announcement next week.
Bolstered by their post-Trump election wins in Normal Township, local Democrats are trying to contest more and more races in McLean County. The latest one is the 88th House District, which includes parts of Bloomington, plus communities like Stanford, Danvers, and Mackinac. It stretches all the way west to Morton and Washington. Jill Blair of Bloomington is a former Heartland Community College administrator, and she's never run for elected office before. She now works for Country Financial. Blair says she's running not specifically because of Sommer, but because of Springfield itself.
I'm running for the 88th District to represent in Springfield because Springfield is broken and really has been for a long time. We've seen the partisan bickering over several decades, political gamesmanship. And meanwhile, hardworking Illinoisans are suffering. We look at our schools, our universities, our hospitals, our farmers and our laborers, our seniors and those with disabilities whose services have been dwindling, and so many more. Really, I think Illinois deserves better, and I'm ready to bring fresh ideas, and I'm committed to better ways forward.
What are going to be the key issues that you raised during the campaign?
One of the top issues for me really is education. Having worked in the community college, I'm familiar with the environment, and I understand how the uncertainty we've been living under for the last couple of years have really affected the services that they're able to provide. And that's not just at the community college level, but obviously K-12. I'm glad to see that we finally have a funding formula that's going to go into law so that, you know, schools can open on time and they'll get their funding hopefully pretty soon here. But we need to do better, and this recent action is just the beginning. There needs to be a lot more done. We've been pretty much at the bottom of the list in terms of how we fund our K-12 schools, and so I understand why people are frustrated with high property taxes, but you have to understand that those property taxes are a product of underfunding of schools from the state, and they're asking the municipalities to make up the difference. I know that we can do better for all Illinois children so that they have quality schools and quality education. Another issue for me is a fair and humane approach to budgeting, which obviously includes for the schools, but for everyone else. As I mentioned before, we've seen our seniors suffering. We've seen folks with disabilities. Their services have disappeared. They've got no place to go. We've seen farmers and laborers and everybody just living under this cloud of uncertainty. And I know that folks, you know, are upset about paying higher taxes, but I don't think it's the higher taxes that forces people to leave the state. It's this cloud of uncertainty when you don't know what to expect in the next quarter or the next year or be able to plan out 2 or 3 years ahead. Business owners are in the same boat. So I want to see a better approach to budgeting. And I think a part of that is a graduated income tax. I'd like to see us adopt a graduated income tax just like virtually every other state in the union. just like we do at the federal government, so that millionaires and billionaires are paying a higher rate than, say, their secretaries and their staff members. I think that's the way that we have to think in order to make up some of the gaps.
You've never held elected office before. So what are some of the factors across the state, across the country, that led you to this now?
I think what's going on at both the national level and at the state level really has been a wake-up call for me over the last couple of years, and the election of 2016 was just kind of the icing on the cake. We see people being driven further apart, in the partisanship and kind of taking up stake for their team instead of thinking about the citizens of the state, the citizens of the United States. We can't sit around anymore and wait for someone else to take action. We can't look for someone else to solve the problems. I'm ready to step forward and take responsibility. I'm motivated to restore Illinois' reputation as one of the best states in the union. I'm really proud of Illinois. I've spent my life here, as I've mentioned, and I know what we're capable of. I know we can be a prosperous and thriving state, and I look forward to being a part of making that happen.
State Representative Summer has not had a Democratic challenger in the general election since 2008. So how are you going to win in a district like this?
Sure. Number one, I want to say this isn't about Keith Summer. It's about the people of Illinois. It's about the residents of the 88th District. That said, I think unopposed elections are bad for democracy. We deserve choices. And I think when we have choices, it opens our eyes to some of the possibilities that are out there that maybe we haven't been exposed to before. Those who do win and hold the seat are, held more accountable. They have to fight in order to represent us, and I think that's the right thing. And as far as flipping this district and turning it to a Democratic district, I've seen a lot of grassroots activity really throughout the area, from Morton, Washington, to here in Bloomington, across McLean County. I think a lot of people feel the same as me, that when they saw what happened in November, that we really need to get more involved. We need to pay attention to what's going on at all levels of government. We need to petition those who represent us. We need to eventually run for office if that's what our calling is. And so I'm ready to make that happen.
You've talked about how you're not running specifically because of Keith Summer. It certainly begs the question, what do you think of his tenure? He's been in the Illinois General Assembly since 1999.
Well, as I said, I'm not running necessarily because of Keith Summer. I'm running for the people of the District of 88, and what I hear from them is that they're frustrated with what's going on in Springfield. They're frustrated with particularly this current Rauner administration, and when I do look at Representative Summer's record, I can't say that he's done much outside of what's been expected of him, as a Republican. I don't know that he's been accountable to his constituents, and I would be. I'm really interested in talking to people across the district, finding out what they're concerned about, what their frustrations are, what their hopes are, and that's really something I want to bring back. What do they want from Illinois? What do they see as the future of Illinois? And what kind of new ideas and fresh solutions can we bring so that we can move forward?
That's Jill Blair from Bloomington, who's running for the 88th House District as a Democrat. That seat is currently held by State Representative Keith Summer, a Republican from Morton. Summer did not respond to requests for an interview for this story. Chris Howick of Bloomington has also announced plans to run in that district as a Libertarian candidate. Howick is the vice chair of the McLean County Libertarian Party. I'm Ryan Denham.
Blair will make her formal campaign announcement next Thursday, September 7th, at the McLean County Museum of History.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Labor Day weekend is nearly here, and we'll look at the state of labor. An iconic grocery store in downtown Bloomington is celebrating a landmark anniversary. The Common Ground is 40 years old tomorrow. Colleen Connolly is a sales associate. Lua Travis bought the Common Ground a year ago, but has worked there for 9 years. Travis says throughout the life of the store, consumption patterns have changed.
There's just been a growing trend of people caring more about where their food comes from, what's in their food. One of our focuses is on organic and local products, and that's something that just in my time here I've noticed has become a lot more important to people in the community.
How do you gauge that? What measures do you take for that? What is it, anecdotal? And if so, what do they say?
I would say it's a lot of what we hear from our customers, what they're asking for. People are pretty open about asking for what they want here, and you know, also seeing new faces come into the store that maybe didn't shop here 2 years ago, and now they care more about where their food is coming from.
What do they ask now that they did not 9 years ago?
A lot more people want to know exactly the city or town their food comes from. They want to know, like for meats and eggs and milk products, they want to know what those animals were fed, really getting into details about their food.
Is there a hyper-locality now that wasn't present? For instance, did Illinois peaches used to be good enough and now Carbondale's too far away? Or what's the geographic sensibility for people now?
This is Colleen here. I don't think necessarily that the vast majority of our customers are that specific with exactly like a certain mile radius there. What I can say about our store is that for the 40 years that we've been open, we have been sourcing local and organic products for that whole period of time. And as Lou was saying, this is just like now becoming a trend, now becoming cool, quote unquote, to have, you know, organic or local products, which is a great thing because that supports our community and we want to support that. But we have been doing that for 40 years now, and I know whenever we have the option to buy something local, if it's between one of our bigger distributors or a place, you know, be it here in Bloomington or here in Champaign or, you know, just in Illinois or the Midwest, we do try to source it from a more local space because that is what our customers would prefer.
Certainly some things have changed in 40 years. What have those been?
Neither of us are that old. We both grew up shopping at the store before we worked here. I'd say a lot of it has stayed the same in the store. I would just say an awareness has broadened through the community where it's not a weird thing anymore to say, I want organic produce.
This is Colleen again. I think a lot of things that have changed here is the vegan and vegetarian population. Which we have been a beacon of, you know, a food source for them for a long period of time. And we do offer, local meats as well, but we also offer different dairy and meat substitutes for folks that are vegan and vegetarian. And I know that that has not always been the case. There has not always been a large population of folks that are looking for those types of foods.
When did that happen?
I'm not sure if I can pinpoint the date, but I think at least within the last 10 years, a lot of people are switching to that lifestyle.
Another thing that we've noticed, too, is a growing number of food allergies.
Yeah.
And that is something that we try to, we have a large gluten-free section, or gluten-free food throughout the store. And then there are more nut allergies and things like that where we have specific products that are certified allergen-free. So those are things that have definitely been more recent years that have come up.
Since you shop there and now run the place, describe the transition from customer to owner or proprietor.
Got to see all behind the scenes. Of course, from first moving from customer to sales associate, and I got to learn a lot about the local economy and where things came from. Then becoming the owner is just a whole different ball game of even more into the details of business. I live and work in downtown, and I have for 8 to 9 years, and it's definitely a family in downtown. Like, I really enjoy getting to know other people that live and work in downtown who are my friends and my customers.
Apart from you, you're pretty much in a food desert there, eh?
Yeah, kind of.
So it's not just the white upper-income folks looking for healthy lifestyles.
No, definitely not. There are people that live right in this area that will walk here.
How has the growth of crop shares and farmers market and now Green Top affected what you do and how you do it and who comes to you?
We're definitely in a phase where we have more competition than we've ever had.
For organizations such as the farmers market and as well, you know, just different grocery stores branching out and supporting local farmers and local vendors are, of course, you know, great, because when you support those local folks, you are, again, supporting your community, and that's what we've been doing for coming on 40 years now in September.
Is it a case of a rising tide lifts all boats, or is it a case of limited market share for this kind of approach to food and you are facing pressure?
You know, I could not say that for certain, but I think that one thing that we do try to offer here at the store that's very unique to us is really the personal care that we give to our customers when they come here. Because we all are a smaller store, a lot of our regular customers, we know them by name, and that way we're able to service them. We do have a large amount of products, especially when you're looking at the vitamins there. People are sometimes unsure what to get because there are just so many options. So we like to take the time to talk with our customers one-on-one so that they're making the right decisions, not only in vitamins, but just in all of our other products there. So we like to build personal relationships with our folks that have been shopping with us for a while or with folks that are new to shopping with us.
Well, that's an excellent opportunity for me to ask about the people and the relationships that you've crafted and see if you have any funny, poignant, or otherwise significant stories to share about people who've been with you for a long time or a short time, if they've made an impression.
Well, there's one customer. He likes to remind us that he was the second customer in the door in 1977, and he's still shopping with us. His name's Bill, and we love Bill, and we love hearing about how he was the second person in the door when Mary Munson opened the store in 1977. So shout out to Bill.
Do people talk about their personal lives? Are you the bartender of grocery stores?
You know? I guess you could say that sometimes. I mean, we hear a lot of people's personal lives because they come in frequently and they get comfortable with us. And we know about, and we see kids grow up. That's something I've really noticed in the 9 years I've been here, is these little kids are now teenagers. Colleen herself, when I started, was like 11.
Yeah, probably.
And I remember her coming in with her mom. And now she works here.
I was probably very obnoxious.
No, you weren't.
Apart from I'm making a living, I'm providing people with things that they need, where is the joy of this business for you?
I've had other retail jobs before, and there's just something extra special about this place that drives me to keep doing it. It's not just a store.
Yeah, I think we were just talking earlier today about the things that make Common Ground special. Like, we were talking about the smell, which I know sounds like weird when you just say it like that, but a lot of times our customers come in and they open the door and they walk in, they're like, it just smells so good in here. And it's just the blend of all the stuff that we have is the fresh bread on bread days. It's the spice island where you can buy spices in bulk, the teas and herbs as well. It's just that blend of all that good stuff that you can buy to make a full meal for your family, or just, you know, something like our hummus that you can just grab and go on your lunch break from work.
So it's the same sort of sensibility as people who imprint on tapioca pudding or the smell of grandma's mac and cheese when they were kids.
Definitely, yes.
Lua Travis is the owner of The Common Ground, and Colleen Connolly is a sales associate at the grocery store in downtown Bloomington. Their 40th anniversary event tomorrow includes live music, giveaways, samples, and food company representatives to talk with customers about the produce and meats and other groceries.
One day in 1973, John Francis decided to stop speaking.
Yeah, but just for one day. But if I had started and someone said, John, you're not going to speak for 17 years, I might not have gone on.
I'm Guy Raz, searching for quiet in a noisy world. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. The TED Radio Hour. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Some unionized workers who felt left behind by economic changes voted for Donald Trump. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In Illinois, Governor Bruce Rauner just vetoed a minimum wage law. Despite that, the head of the Bloomington Normal Trades and Labor Assembly tells GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds in this Sound Ideas interview, the state of labor is better than some might think. As we approach Labor Day, Mike Matika looks at the state of unions, not the state of the union. Matika says it's an interesting time for labor.
Because I think if you took a long-term view with this, we're in the middle of some profound economic adjustment. And a lot of our labor law and systems were built for industrial America in the 1930s and 1940s. And so, big picture, what do you do with a contingent economy where a lot of people are working 60-hour weeks and totally fried out, and other people can't get enough work to take care of themselves, or working at the fast food or the big box store, and because they're working part-time, multiple jobs, don't have health care, don't have benefits, don't have pensions. I look at how the labor movement had to historically adjust to a changing economy, and sometimes it takes a while for people's organizations to catch up to those things. And at the same time, I think in other areas, things are going well, but at the same time, we in Illinois are kind of an island. Thanks to Mike Madigan, Bruce Rauner was not able to destroy unions like his Republican counterparts in Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Missouri have done over the last 2 years, and been able to hold up for people's rights within this state.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. We know the governor just a few days ago vetoed the minimum wage bill. Last check, it didn't look like there were enough votes to override. What does that say?
Well, I mean, when you look at what Rauner called his turnaround agenda, which really was eroding people's rights, taking away wages, and taking away people's rights to organize, he's not been successful in doing that. He has been successful in using administrative things like his veto and his control of things like the Illinois Department of Labor to stifle law, and in some ways to prevent enforcement of existing Illinois law so that people's wages and people's conditions are not being upheld.
Are you talking about the prevailing wage? Or what other violations of adhering to the law is he guilty of?
And as a laborer, our organization has had 4 lawsuits against Rauner's administration, against his Department of Labor, and we won all 4 of them on the construction prevailing wage for his department's failure to properly set wages and to enforce those. Another one we're watching closely is independent contractor laws, because Illinois on paper has very strict laws which define who is actually an employee, and you have to meet 14 different points, all 14 of them, to actually be considered an independent contractor in the state of Illinois. And we are getting very, very weak enforcement from the Illinois Department of Labor on a variety of measures. And again, that's one way, even though he has not been able to change law legislatively, lack of enforcement can make a real difference for people in a negative way.
And what about the state budget impasse? Has that had an impact specifically on unions and what has happened in their situations?
Well, yeah, what big problem with the state budget impact is infrastructure. You know, if you don't have a state budget, you're not fixing your roads, you're not fixing your bridges, you're not updating our infrastructure. And when the governor complains about jobs leaving Illinois, one of the key ingredients of economic success is having a vital infrastructure system so businesses are attracted to the state because they know they can move their product and people can get to their workplaces. And at the same time, attempts to curtail public employee laws and the refusal to negotiate a contract with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, with AFSCME, you know, those folks have been hanging now throughout the Rauner administration trying just to maintain their contractual rights.
Are there other wins that you have seen in Illinois in, say, the past year?
Two things. It's very fascinating to watch the Fight for 15, which is, again, people at the bottom of the economic tier starting to stand up, people who work in big box minimum wage, who work in fast food, saying we should make enough money to live without public assistance, without needing welfare to go to work every day. And that's a long-term national issue. It's interesting that it's playing itself out at the city and state level more than it is at the federal level. And I think the other thing in the construction trades that we've really been pushing that I don't think the people, average person doesn't realize the investment we make out of our own pockets in apprenticeship and training to make sure that there is a competent and ready workforce out there, that we do it without public assistance.
I want to go back quickly to the minimum wage. Governor Rauner has said that economic evidence suggests that a big wage hike actually hurts workers more than it helps. And he, I think, cited, you know, he cites some studies, I think, by the University of Michigan.
Yeah, and there, you know, there's all kinds of studies around those issues. It's very fascinating that a number, I'll use one in New Jersey a couple of years ago, similar academic study that found when minimum wages went up, there really was no detrimental impact on employment. And I think what people forget is right now our economy is set up to make the wealthy wealthier. And that seems to be the big goal, with the hope that somehow that's going to trickle down. The more average people have a decent wage and a decent way of life, that money bubbles up. And it gets spent in the local grocery store, it gets spent at the local restaurant, it gets spent at the local car dealer. What's that magic formula? It's probably different for a small business with two or three employees than it is for Walmart, or a large employer that has thousands of people who are dependent upon public assistance to make a living. And how do you do this in a way that's as cognizant of the needs of small business, but also looks at large employers who aren't necessarily paying people a living wage?
Is there some sort of sweet spot or maybe a graduated way of looking at this or scaling it so that small business isn't as heavily impacted?
I'm sure there is, you know, and I mean, you have to look at what's the cost of living in a major metropolitan area versus cost of living in a rural area. You know, our cost of living in Bloomington Normal, our cost of housing is higher than some surrounding cities around here. You know, and how much do you dig down in that? I'm sure there are 37 economists at Illinois State University who could give you 37 opinions on this. But I think it's something we need to talk about in the larger sense as a society, is how do we make sure that we are living in an equitable society, particularly as automation takes more and more jobs.
We're talking with local labor leader Mike Matika. This is Sound Ideas, and I'm Colleen Reynolds, and we're looking ahead at Labor Day and assessing the state of labor. Let's go nationally a little bit, and when you look at Trump election victory, lots of unions got behind him, mostly because of his positions on trade. And so it seems that could usually be counted on as a solid Democratic vote was no longer solid. Do you see that holding, or what do you predict is going to happen there?
It's fascinating because organized labor did not endorse Trump. You know, unions very much backed the Democratic Party. Some union members did go for Trump. And I think the sales job that I'm going to destroy NAFTA, I'm going to take away all these trade agreements, is very appealing. So far, we haven't seen any evidence of a new agreement that's any fairer to people. And a lot of this, I think, has been PR. You know, we look at the carrier plant in Indiana where he came in and we're going to save all these jobs. Well, he moved the jobs to Mexico anyway. And there's two things that need to be looked at. One is automation, because automation is taking just as many jobs as trade is. And at the same time, people do have legitimate concerns about trade issues. And sometimes the Democrats have been weak in terms of addressing trade issues, making sure that people are protected in the process. And also, there are a lot of tax programs and other things that actually give subsidy to send jobs overseas. So how do we do that in a way that not just protects American jobs, but also gives people equal opportunity with countries that may not be enforcing environmental law, labor laws, organizing, right to organize a union laws that we have in this country?
There are some people who are looking at the labor movement and saying some workers whose wages have remained fairly stagnant because of the economy, and they're so busy working, they're kind of resentful of the idea of giving up more of that to unions when in some cases they feel like maybe they're not seeing the benefits. And so some people are saying unions appear to be becoming more irrelevant. Even at the same time, they are helping and expanding into more workplaces, such as home health care workers and even the medical marijuana industry.
And I think the important thing, you know, that's a line that's been used for many years. Stop and think, do you have a voice on the job or don't you have a voice on the job? And that's the really important role that labor plays. Sometimes people think of unions and their first reaction is, what are the wages and what are the benefits? Those are generally better because people have a voice. And if you're out there as a lone individual, you're often in a take-it-or-leave-it situation. If you have a way as a group of workers to organize together, and people forget that unions are democratic institutions. You know, contracts are negotiated not because an elected union leader sits down and negotiates it. That elected officer has to come back to the membership, and the membership has a voice. And if there's a safety problem, if there is an unfair treatment problem, you've got a mechanism to stand up and say, I deserve to be treated humanely. And that's really the essence of what a labor union is.
So moving ahead and looking at the next 12 months, where do you see unions and the union movement heading? What other work sectors and what other initiatives as far as training? And then, of course, politically.
I mean, it's going to be a very fascinating political year between now and next September. You know, we will have statewide elections here in Illinois. There'll be congressional elections. I think it's going to be very critical that people don't just say they're against Ron or they're against Trump, but you actually have to lay out a vision. And that vision has to be something that appeals to people and say, look, here's how we can improve your lives. Here's how things can be better. Here's some laws that we need to look at, because it's very true that some fascinating numbers that as union membership has declined, middle class wages have stagnated and the rich have gotten richer. So, you know, how do we turn that where do the very wealthy need all the money they're getting, or can we reinvest that back into average people, which eventually the wealthy are still going to make out very well in the process. But it always perturbs me that you have people working full-time who still need government assistance. And I think if people were being paid decently, we could actually cut some taxes because people would not be dependent on medical assistance and food and welfare.
So a Brookings Institute study found in their survey of people who are employed that 50% of them who are non-union say if an election were held in their workplace tomorrow, they would vote for union representation. Yet union membership is declining. It seems like that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think two things that happen there. Because union membership is down, a lot of people don't understand the process. And they think that, okay, a union's going to appear at my door one day and make it happen. Unions happen because people organize. And it really only is effective when a group of people get together amongst themselves and organize and then create a union or turn to a union to represent them. But a union is not going to come knocking at your door saying, hey, can we represent you people? You know, it has to be organic. It has to grow from that group of workers. And I think because people don't understand their rights, they don't know that they have that right to organize, to stand up for themselves, and to build an organization that works for them. I think the other difficulty is, particularly with federal labor law, it's a very convoluted process, and companies have, basically, it's how to compare it. If you're running a presidential election in the United States, and you were the party on the out, and you had to do all your campaigning from Canada, how effective could you be? If you're organizing a workplace, that employer can call all the meetings they want, to spread all the anti-union messages they want, but the union has to stand outside the gate and only deliver their message during workers' free time. So it creates a real imbalance where people are often frightened. Are not uncommon in a factory situation to suddenly machines start getting sticker slapped on them that say, prepare to move this machine to Mexico, you know, and that may or may not be true, but it's a way to frighten people from voting for representation.
Will we see the strengths of local unions at the Labor Day parade? Is ours one of the bigger or better?
You know, it's always fascinating because when we talk to our counterparts in other communities, we get a really good community response to the parade here and very strong attendance. And I always point out to folks, because we really try hard to be a community institution, our local unions do a lot of volunteering, doing a lot of donated labor. I think people see that oftentimes unions are written off as some kind of outside force. And there's been a real effort in McLean County to integrate with the business community, to integrate with community organizations and charities, to show we've got something to contribute and we can play a vital role. We may not have big money, but we can donate our time. And you see that in numerous projects around the community where local union donated labor has made a big difference. And I think the other fun thing with our parade is a lot of parades march through just through the downtowns. We go into the neighborhood, and I think that just brings people out and makes it more of a community event.
Well, we look forward to seeing you there, Mike, and happy Labor Day.
Thank you very much.
GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talked with Laborers Local stalwart Mike Matika. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The most popular digital currency in the world now has its first physical presence in Bloomington Normal. The community's first Bitcoin ATM machine was recently installed at 707 Liquors on Linden Street near Uptown Normal. Users can put in their cash and have Bitcoins added to their digital wallets, sort of like a reverse ATM for the age of cryptocurrency. Joe Ciccolo of Bloomington Normal is a Bitcoin consultant. He wasn't involved with the new ATM, but in this rebroadcast of a conversation from April, Ciccolo talks about what he does and what's next for Bitcoin.
I consult with various Bitcoin entrepreneurs with respect to their compliance and regulatory obligations. Early on, there were a lot of sort of tech anarchists and sort of rebels, if you will, in the Bitcoin space. And I like to think that they've since been replaced by entrepreneurs. And through that movement, we've seen a lot of folks come into the marketplace with various different ideas, products, and services, and fascinating business models. But you have to understand that this is in the world of financial services where there's some serious regulatory implications. And so I work with my clients to understand what the requirements are in terms of regulations and how best to comply with them.
what are some of the business models of the people you deal with?
Sure. So we deal with a lot of Bitcoin ATM operators. So just as the name might imply, it's sort of a take on the legacy ATMs, as it were, today, that are retrofitted to do a transaction into and out of Bitcoin. I also work with Bitcoin exchanges. Much like a currency exchange, maybe you'll see one at an airport or a mall. Very similar. In this case, they're all online, and they deal with the exchange of fiat or dollar-based currency for Bitcoin and vice versa.
Governments couldn't figure out what to do at first. They decidedly didn't like the idea of not being able to tax this trading that was going on. Regulation has started to creep in. Talk a little bit about the regulatory landscape now. What sorts of safeguards are there, and how does entrepreneurial behavior still happen in less than a Wild West fashion?
Sure. Yeah, so that's a bit of a misconception. There is quite a bit of regulation around the actors, the folks that have entrepreneurial ventures within the Bitcoin space. So it's a veritable alphabet soup, if you will, of government agencies that are involved. We have FinCEN, which is Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. It's an arm of the U.S. Treasury. They enforce Bitcoin exchanges and ATMs and other means of getting into and out of Bitcoin, and they interpret that activity as money transmitter activity. We also have the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, that has said in certain cases Bitcoin is a commodity.
Not a security, but a commodity.
A commodity, right. It's funny you mentioned securities. The SEC has also weighed in certain circumstances. Bitcoin, depending on how it is offered, could be considered a security. And then for tax purposes, the IRS has said Bitcoin is property. And so I joke with my clients and friends in the industry, anytime someone asks, well, which is it? I say all of the above.
Obviously, you can do business anywhere because it's an online business and a consulting business. You've chosen to live in Bloomington Normal. Why? What makes Bloomington Normal great for a Bitcoin entrepreneur?
That's a great question. No, it's actually a great location. I tell my clients that I'm halfway between St. Louis and Chicago, both of which are really strong markets for the Bitcoin and the payment space. And I really enjoy the quality of life here in Bloomington Normal. So that's kept me anchored down here.
What kinds of businesses use Bitcoin?
Merchants could accept Bitcoin. There are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands at this point internationally, of merchants that accept Bitcoin. It's a great way to avoid chargebacks, which I know is something of a four-letter word in the area of retail. So you can avoid chargebacks. The swipe fee is not there as it would be for a credit card, where you could pay, in some cases I've heard, up to 3%. Per transaction goes to the credit card company and the various institutions involved in that transaction. So there's an obvious benefit for retailers to accept Bitcoin, and not to mention it opens you up to a new population of prospective customers that may not necessarily have used your services before. So Overstock.com is a great example. They would readily admit that they have appealed towards a more female audience in terms of where they position themselves in the marketplace. By opening up to techies and to folks that may not necessarily fit their profile for a customer, they've really introduced a new set of customers that wouldn't otherwise use their services. So retail would definitely benefit. I think the best area that Bitcoin is suited for is international remittances, because the system we have now just doesn't work. It's broken. You're waiting, in some cases, 5 to 7 days to send a transaction somewhere else in the world. And when we have a very globalized society, we have a lot of immigrants sending money home to families. They have to rely on a system of many different actors and place their trust in those actors in that system in order to send funds home. And not to mention the exorbitant rates that in some cases they're charged for that service, when in fact they can do it instantaneously from their smartphone using Bitcoin.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Joe Ciccolo, a Bitcoin entrepreneur and consultant, about the business of cryptocurrency. How much has use of Bitcoin expanded in the last 8 years, and how stable is it now? It used to have larger fluctuations in value.
Sure. I think early on it was something of an anomaly. I think a lot of techies were using it. There was a lot of reticence in terms of adoption by the folks that are in more of a mainstream situation versus versus some of the tech players out there who were living and breathing the technology. They understood cryptographic technology and consensus algorithms and some of those technical terms that were very difficult to sell to the average person. And I think over time, as we begin to see the utility and the application of Bitcoin, you've seen a dramatic increase in adoption.
Ordinary currencies are backed by governments. Some items are backed by bullion or some other good that it securitizes it. How is Bitcoin backed?
Bitcoin is backed by math. It's backed by mathematical principles. It is software. It's an open source program. Anyone can download the code and examine it. Several people have. There is no backing to it in terms of, obviously, government authority. It's completely decentralized. And so it's trust in the system and trust in people that are involved in the system. The number of Bitcoins will be capped at 21 million. It's embedded in the code. So consider that a mathematical formula. There's 21 million Bitcoin that will ever exist. There'll never be more. There'll never be less. And they're mined into existence on a predictable scale in accordance with the software program.
There is increasing competition in cryptocurrencies. China has begun to look at issuing its own cryptocurrency. It really didn't like Bitcoin all that much. And there is an Australian mining firm that is issuing its own Oz currency that is backed by gold. What is the competitive landscape for cryptocurrencies, and how do you see it developing?
I think in terms of participants, it's very competitive. But in terms of actual results, Bitcoin has the lion's share of the cryptocurrency market. There are literally thousands of what are called altcoins, the alt standing for alternative. So there are any number of Peercoin, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Dash. The list goes on and on. And many of these are just more pet projects or casual interest. Again, Bitcoin had that first mover advantage. They were able to capture that lion's share of the market. You mentioned some of the other players involved in this. It's no surprise that governments are going to try to issue their own currency. I think we're used to a centralized system of financial services. People have joked that, one day we'll see Fedcoin mm-hmm. from the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. That certainly wouldn't surprise me. I think that there is a desire to get involved from government's perspective. I think what it really comes down to is we are going to have digital currency. Is it going to be centralized, decentralized, or both? Right. I think the model of having cash and money in physical form, as I'm sure many of us have experienced on a daily basis, when was the last time we used cash or how often do we use cash in our daily activities?
Less and less frequently.
Exactly. So I think it's going to come down to a digital finance.
So what are the arguments for centralization and decentralization?
So great question. I think the argument against centralization is the intersection between the state and banking that we have now. So there is a lot of oversight of financial activities through the banks. There are a lot of voices within the Bitcoin community very concerned about the authority that the Federal Reserve has over our monetary system. And you can probably read in between the lines, if you will, in the original white paper that was issued when Bitcoin was launched, that there are a lot of overtones and criticisms of the fiscal monetary policy of this country, or sort of more pointedly, the market meltdown of 2008. It's unsurprising that there are those considerations. So that's sort of the downside. When you talk about having decentralized cryptocurrencies, you don't have any central actor involved. So there's really no appeal to authority. Depending on who you ask, that could be a feature or a bug. So there are definitely those considerations. And I think ultimately we're probably going to have a mix of centralized and decentralized. And it's hard to argue when there are different options out there for different applications.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Joe Ciccolo, a Bitcoin consultant, about cryptocurrencies. The pro is that it's secure and anonymous. The con is that it's secure and anonymous. There have been concerns by any number of governments about Bitcoin being used in illicit trafficking of drugs and other goods. How should people address that concern?
It's a very valid concern. Early on, I think Bitcoin was dominated by headlines about Silk Road, the online marketplace where It seemed you could buy anything under the sun that was illegal, among other things that you could purchase online. And so Bitcoin got a bad name right out of the gate. But I think as people began to explore it and really looked at the technology and looked at the ways in which it was being used, several governments, including the UK Treasury, has come out and said, look, we don't really think that Bitcoin is high risk for terrorist funding or other money laundering activities. And I understand that that debate is going to continue to go on. But I think the best way to think about Bitcoin is it's not anonymous, right? I think that's one myth we really have to dispel. It's semi-anonymous. So while you can see the transactional activity on the blockchain in terms of the address of the sender and the receiver, you don't have their personal information, their name, address, and social security number, which is obviously a good thing. We don't want everybody to have that public information, but you are able to see some attributes. And using old-fashioned police activities, law enforcement has been able to, in the case of Silk Road, for example, piece together that activity and be able to trace it back to the illicit actor, or ultimately trace it to a destination that is an entity with which can be served a subpoena.
That new Bitcoin ATM in Normal is operated by a company called CoinFlip. The website Coin ATM Radar shows it's the third Bitcoin ATM in downstate Illinois, joining machines in Champaign and Gilman. Chicolo says the location inside a liquor store next to Pub 2 makes sense. Liquor stores tend to be open longer hours than other retail, and it's close to Uptown Normal. Thanks to Ryan Denham and Colleen Reynolds for today's show. You can hear full episodes and individual stories at our website, WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org.